I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The midterm measure of the American mood in Trump time may well turn out to be not, or not just, the off-year House and Senate election scorecard, but rather the workplace turmoil all over the map this year. Workers who never organized before, in grad schools, in media, in sex work, in prisons, are talking solidarity. And notice, the word strike is back in circulation, inspired maybe by the furious telemarketers in that seriously funny fantasy film, Sorry to Bother You. In the movie, the telemarketers shout, "Phones down!" In real Boston, this week, housekeepers in three Marriott-owned hotels downtown could soon be shouting, "Mops down!" in their fight for a new contract.
Brian Lang, I'm the president of Unite Here Local 26. We're looking for reasonable and fair increases in our incomes. So instead of having to work two and three jobs, people who work as full-time hotel workers can live in the city of Boston and around the city of Boston, raise their families, and retire with dignity. We think that Marriott and the hotel industry has made plenty of money over the last 5 years, and now's the time to share the wealth that has been created by hotel workers in this city. We're taking a strike vote on September 12th, and if Marriott doesn't come to its senses over the course of the month of September, they may have to weather a strike.
We are in the workplace, not the political arena this hour, though of course they are connected. As soon as workers say it's all about the power of the corporate class, they say it's a fight about places at the table, a fight about restoring an idea of people power democracy. Our guest, Gabriel Winant, is an historian now in the thick of the insurgencies at work, particularly among famously non-union professional workers. Chris Mackin has been studying and reforming workplaces for 40 years now, often wondering how it came to be that capital hires workers to build a company and do a job instead of workers hiring money toward the same goals. Jane McAlevey sounds the keynote. She's an activist, author, and teacher who seems to thrive on uphill battles. Jane McAlevey in San Francisco, you are part of the turbulence in the workplace east and west. What are you seeing out there?
Oh, first of all, it's really nice to be here.
Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, you know what I'm seeing across the country is the beginning of a very dynamic sort of rebuilt new labor movement. Hmm. And in this new labor movement, there's so many exciting aspects to it, but one of them, a central one, is that for the first time ever, we may be looking at a future that's a women-led trade union movement, and it's women who work in what I describe in my book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power, as women who work in the mission-driven sectors of the U.S. economy. Now, what's important about—so let me first say what I mean by that. Mission-driven means healthcare workers and education workers. And there's a lot of evidence. There's been a lot of organizing and a lot of resistance taking place in the education and the healthcare sector. We certainly saw a wave of strikes, all through West Virginia, Oklahoma, all these different places, right, in the spring. But part of what is so interesting about what these women are doing right now is that they are challenging some of the historic norms, well, the dominant norms of the last 40 years or so inside the union movement, and they're doing it because they're making the case for something far beyond wages and far beyond benefits. They're actually making the case for a better American society, and they're laying it bare in the fight for education and the fight for a better healthcare system.
Let me just say, it's very touching. It's bringing it home. These are family. Not chores, it's family work that they're doing, caring. I mean, I would call them the caring professions. But it also sounds, if I dare say, Jane, almost pre-modern. Maybe pre-modern in a good way, but is that stuff for this world?
Yeah, I think it's actually a great question for several reasons. So one is, I think what a lot of the women in the fields are fighting about is the fact that they are a profession. I don't find many of the women who I work with. So I've been working in this field for most of my adult life, right? I'm a trade union organizer. I'm a trade union negotiator. I spend an inordinate amount of time with educators and healthcare workers. They're the two sectors I've worked in most in the actual field. And the first thing that they say is, look, we're professionals. A registered nurse is a serious degree. A teaching credential is a real degree. So there is a fight for dignity. And I think that the fight for dignity is always part of labor struggle, to be perfectly honest. But they are in sectors of the economy. Here's what's interesting. They relate to their communities. You were touching on this. But why I think the movement's going to be so powerful is they relate to their own communities in fundamentally different ways than sort of the men of the industrial era who were sort of locked behind the plant gates and no one knew them when they were producing our cars or whatever else they were producing, right? That actually was central to our society. There's no question about that. But in terms of strategy in the Trump era, to have millions of women forming unions who traditionally have not had unions. There are tens of millions of women in just the healthcare field, just among registered nurses, who have never had a union, who are not yet union, who are finally realizing the only way that they're going to be able to deliver the kind of care to their patients that they went to nursing school to deliver is by forming together, clubbing up, and if that sounds old-fashioned, it's still working for them all over the country. Whenever nurses and healthcare professionals and teachers and other education professionals in the field are forming unions, they're actually winning the kind of gains that we saw men in the factories winning in the 1930s in this country. And that is exciting.
This is irreverent, but it just occurs to me, this is so much like George Carlin talking about the difference between football and baseball and the way men do things and, in your description, women. In the Carlin routine, men find a way to make it to make it war. They do it on a gridiron in the war stadium. In baseball, the job is to be safe at home. That's the world you're describing. I would call it the caring economy, the human economy. But what about that muscular, money-making corporate sector, dare I say, the uncaring economy, Jane?
Well, here's what's really interesting. So what we've heard a lot about in the last sort of decade or so, right, there's been a lot of chatter in the mainstream media. There's chatter in our newspapers. There's chatter in society about something that's called income inequality. And what I like to say is there's a recognition right now that income inequality is grotesque. We are seeing it at levels that we haven't seen since 1929 in the United States of America, right? In our last Gilded Age. We're essentially in a new Gilded Age again. And what's really interesting is the way we got out of the last Gilded Age was by recognizing that you can't overcome an income inequality in American society without actually challenging the power inequality. When workers have no say, no voice, no ability to come together and challenge management day to day in the workplace, it's a reflection of what's happening in society at large. And so in the 1920s, there were brutal wars fought in this country. We don't know our history very well. I'm glad Gabe's going to be on the show. We don't know our history very well in this country. Knowing our history is very important. But if you look at the what I call strategic sectors right now, The interesting thing about the caring profession, the mission-driven women who are building a new trade union movement in this country, is that you can't offshore their jobs. You can't move them to China. And they're the growth sectors of the U.S. economy. So for all the talk about the gig economy, the growth sectors, the wildly growing sector in our society, is the healthcare sector as the baby boom is aging. So you're seeing women seizing control finally in the workplace, demanding justice, demanding that they can take care of their patients, demanding they can teach their children better, and they have inseparable bonds with their community.
It's fabulously interesting news for Boston, if I may say, capital of education and of medical care. But there's also a fascinating story of gender difference here. I mean, you're really explaining in a way how a men's labor movement built around battles in the Colorado mines and River Rouge auto plants failed to stop the drive of capital to take us into a two-tier and highly unequal society. We're asking women, in effect, to start again and take us in another direction.
Yeah, no, and listen, I mean, I truthfully, I think that the trade union movement of the 30s and 40s was absolutely heroic, dynamic, fascinating. Women actually played like an auxiliary role in a lot of the fights. That was totally fascinating on the picket lines. But what's different is if you look at teachers for just a minute.
Please.
There has been a 20-year war waged on the idea of the teachers' unions in this country. It's been deliberate. It's been methodical. It's been intentional. We had Waiting for Superman. We had Hollywood movies. We've had endless books and reports talking about how it's teachers and teachers' unions and their greedy nature that are destroying our public education system. And A, that's a lie. And B, despite a multi-million dollar funded campaign to make Americans not like their teachers, the truth of the matter is, in six strikes in six states between mid-February and May of 2018, to a strike, every single time the parents and the students and the communities came out standing with their teachers in defense of public education. And I think we're going to see more of that. And that's part of what makes it so exciting. These women are seen as heroes in their community. They're highly relational with the parents and students that they work with. It's a very different kind of production process. It's real. It's professional. It's serious. But the nature of what we call production in the caring and mission professions means that you're working with your constituent, in essence.
Jane, you make it sound like a revolution, for one thing, a very welcome one, a sort of a feminized revolution of everything. And surely Oklahoma has demonstrated an incredible love of those teaching professions. It's almost, is it too good to be true?
No, it's not too good to be true. It's real. It's women-led. It's a lot of women of color. It's a set of people who have a different kind of relationship to their community, and I think that they are going to be... Look, we have... Under capitalism, workers have to fight in the political arena and also in the workplace because Jane, management and capital fights on both those fronts.
Jane McAlevey, hold it right there, but don't go away. Coming up, an old ideal of industrial democracy akin to political democracy, in which workers would not be rented people, but sharers in effort and achievement. The CEO of General Electric once advocated that vision in 1927. This is Open Source. Gabriel Winant is a labor historian. He was part of the drive at Yale to get graduate students into a union. He writes on the unfolding struggle in The Guardian from London, and in N+1 from Brooklyn. Welcome, Gabriel Winant. Place this moment we're in historically, a time like when?
Well, I think the important thing to begin with is that there's a fundamental tension built into American democracy between democratic self-governance of the people and private ownership of property and profit-making. And the founders knew this, and it's, you know, key to all of the debates in the Constitution going all the way back, that tension exists, and that tension goes through cycles. So periodically, we get into a moment where that tension gets really, really great, where on the one hand, the private dictatorship that you're in every day when you go to work, right? Because your boss is a dictator. It's not a democracy at your workplace. Your boss is a dictator unless you have a union. So the private dictatorship that you're in every day and the public democracy that you nominally have as an American citizen, as the economy changes and new people get put into new economic situations, that gap can get very great. So there's a couple of good examples of this. One very well-known one that historians like to talk about is the run-up to the American Civil War in the middle of the 19th century. Right, that's a period when many, many Americans were used to being able to secure their means. White Americans were used to being able to secure their means of living on their own. They were accountable to no one. Right, they owned their own land, or they worked at a workshop that they, you know, were the master of themselves. And to work for wages was seen as kind of a low-down, subservient thing to do. Abraham Lincoln famously said, you know, I worked for wages as a young man. That was a fine thing to do when I was a young man. But, you know, I grew up, and now I stand on my own 2 feet, and that's how it should be for everybody. But as the Industrial Revolution got going, it got harder and harder to stand on your own 2 feet as a master craftsman of your workshop or as an independent farmer. And in the meantime, the growth of slavery and the contest over what was going to happen with the American West and whether that land would be slave or free Northerners looked at that and they thought, if I want to be able to own my own land and not work for wages, I need that land to not have slaves on it. I need that land to not have slave masters on it. And so they drove them into the Republican Party. And what you see in that dynamic is a question of, is it possible actually? What do we have to do? What kind of social change do we have to make to preserve a democracy in the context of these vast concentrations of property-owning wealth, that's to say slave-owning wealth in that context? And ultimately, they had to fight a very bloody war.
Of big ideas in that history, Gabe, but go back to the simple contraction of industrial unionism.
Yeah.
And Jane is saying a rebirth of a lot of the same ideas and impulses in the caring economy.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more with Jane. I mean, so what we're seeing today is a social contract that we built up over the 20th century about, you know, how if you worked hard and you got a job, you could have a career, you could have benefits, you could raise kids, you could send them to school, you know, you'd have health care, you'd have a pension. All of that has been eroded, right, down to nothing. I mean, who has a pension anymore, right?
How do you spell that? No, go ahead.
But we haven't actually changed our institutions that much. We haven't really acknowledged all of those changes that have happened. So just to stay, to keep incomes level since the 1970s, Americans have had to produce many, many, many more working hours, right? Real wages are declining or stagnating. People are working harder, they're working more, and they have much less security than they once had. And this is calling into doubt for many millions of American workers what they thought they knew about who they were and where they stood in American society. And that's the comparison I was making to the 1850s, what people thought they were somewhere in American society. And then they wake up one day and they realize things don't work that way anymore.
Let me say, I'm one of those professionals you write about a lot, with at least the illusion of independence. I can contract for my wits or my work, my service, on an individual basis, and it seems to work. But these are the people who are most or are conspicuous of being drawn to a new unionism. What's that all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a massive wave of professional unionism that's been developing over the last several years, and you see it, in education, as Jane was talking about, is the most striking and inspiring example, but also in healthcare and nursing, in academia, which is part of my origin, in journalism, it's very dramatic. And what it's about is a historical change in the status of professionals and what we think of as the professions in our society. So what characterizes professional work, right, when you think about it, it's someone who is usually credentialed in some way. You have a nursing degree or a teaching certificate or something like that. In the case of academia, you might have a PhD or be working on one. And that credential means that you're supposed to be able to kind of manage yourself to some degree, right? There's someone over you, but they're not looking over your shoulder every minute. You're not punching a time clock in the same way as someone working at McDonald's. There's some autonomy that's built into professional work, supposedly. And that's a lot of what attracts people to it. I know that's true for me and a lot of my colleagues in academia. People want to go into academia so they can kind of set their own agenda and set their own pace.
Right. It is sort of making alliances to keep you individual and sovereign.
Right. But what's happened over the last several decades, and especially since the 2008 financial crisis, is the employers of many professionals have put more and more and more pressure on professional labor. So you can look at almost any kind of professional work and you see this. In education, as Jane was saying, right, the ratio of students to teachers has gone way up as budgets have gotten cut. Hmm. Right, teachers have to spend more money out of pocket on supplies. They're getting asked to work longer hours for, less pay relatively. In healthcare, there's systematic understaffing, which is why in Massachusetts right now there's an initiative on the ballot to mandate a minimum level of nurse staffing in hospitals. And, if you talk to an RN, they'll tell you that they have to do paperwork all day. They don't get to really, connect to patients the way they like to and the way the good care depends on. In academia, a huge majority of the teaching in academia is now done by people who are hired semester to semester, class by class, rather than, the tenure track or tenured professor you think of. And in all these cases, in journalism, right, people have to kind of compete for clicks online and they can't invest in the serious kind of reporting that used to be the standard. Hundreds of thousands of journalism jobs have been lost over a very short time in this country. And in all of these cases, what's happening is declining margins for employers or, in some cases, financial investors who acquire might be a media outlet or might be investing in, university or different things. But one way or another, more and more pressure on professional workers to put out more with less security.
I want to come back to where all that is leading, but I want to introduce Chris Mackin, friend of 40 years or so, Chris, and you've been part of another movement in the workplace toward worker ownership of the companies and the industries that they work in. I remember your first big success, as I recorded it, was with United Airlines taking that home to the workers, which is history now. But you see all of this with an idea of industrial democracy, but a very different framework. What do you make of the current moment and even the fighting spirit that we hear from Jane McAlevey?
Well, I hear that and agree with Jane and Gabe that there's a lack of justice in the workplace, and we have to figure out how to get it. And I sort of departed from a sort of collective bargaining approach to justice in the workplace many years ago when I fell in love with a 19th century vision of labor leaders who thought that the objective of a labor movement was to help workers and managers own and control the firm, that they rejected the idea of the employer-employee relationship. They rejected the idea of some people owning the company and other people working for them for a wage. They said, let's come together and own and control these firms themselves. And they didn't say that singing hymns. They were in competition with a sort of a newly arrived industrial capitalism in the 19th century. And farmers and people working in small shops were being introduced to the idea of going to work for a wage for the first time, becoming an employee. And many of them didn't like it, didn't like that proposition. They liked being professionals. They liked being independent. And so they said, well, if the steam engine is here to stay, if it makes sense to make 1,000 shoes a week rather than 100 shoes a week, then we're going to do that together. We're going to buy the equipment, and we're going to compete with European-funded capitalism. That's how I got started in this business. And there was a bunch of 20th century interventions in the tax code that have made that possible for there to be a genuine sector in the American economy of companies that are broadly based and broadly owned by their employees.
But what is the record? Hundreds, maybe thousands of instances. What has it proved?
Well, it's more than that. I mean, there are just with a structure called ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Plans alone, there are 7,000 companies that employ about 12 million workers, the biggest being public supermarkets down in Florida and Georgia, 183,000 workers in that company. Here in Boston, Harpoon Brewing Company is owned by 300 of its workers, sold to a legal trust representing everybody there by the founders, who could have sold to Budweiser or private equity, but instead decided to sell internally. This has been going on because, in part, there are Russell Long, the son of Huey Long, introduced tax laws that make it attractive for business owners of healthy businesses to sell on their way out when they're looking to retire. There's another option on the table now. You can sell internally to your people.
What do you make, Chris Mackin, of the romance and the language of confrontation, to the barricades, to organize every last worker, and we'll beat those bastards
the
land?
I know plenty of CEOs and managers and engineers who are not bastards. And I think there's a little bit of an oversimplification that we've been dealing with here. I believe in structures. I believe in justice. I believe that workers need to be able to speak without fear or favor. I think ESOPs are not perfect because often they can't speak independently enough, but they have the first step along the way to a democratic structure by virtue of owning the companies. Chris, the vision here is one of democratic firms where everybody's taking responsibility, where it isn't one side against another, where people are genuinely hiring capital, that labor is management and employees. And I think that's a vision that's been around for a long time. You mentioned Owen Young. We'll talk about him later, I guess. The CEO of General Electric, 100 years into capitalism as we know it in 1927, he advocated He dreamed of a time when there should be no hired men. He wanted the firm, he wanted General Electric to be owned by its workers and its managers.
I want to go back to Jane McAlevey in San Francisco, precisely on what seems the wonderfully old-fashioned spirit of your battles, Jane, but also a kind of, pre-modern, dare I say, anachronistic framing of the thing.
You know, it's interesting because I don't actually think it is anachronistic. I think if you look
at
where
either.
We have...
I'm not sure either. I wasn't accusing.
Yeah, no, look, if you look at the history of this country, two things have been true. There has always been struggle going on between management and workers, right? Between the elite class and workers in this economy. Always true. There's always been struggle. The moments when workers and ordinary people in America have found times when we are doing better, when our kids are doing better than us, when things appear to be doing better, have all resulted from a series of massive strike waves in this country. That's the fact of the history. And I think we're seeing, thank goodness, we're seeing a new attempt by new sets of American workers, again, largely women, often women of color, who are working inside of what I call structured, you know, they're still structured, what we think of as a normal structured workplace. And I think it's interesting to think about whether it's employee stock ownership. I mean, if we could get there, that's great. I think it's interesting to think about the so-called gig economy. But there's something that belies that if you really look at the statistics and the numbers right now, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people in our country are still actually going to a regular job. Well, they may not punch the clock. They may swipe a little card right now or who knows what. But there's a sort of overstatement right now of the quote-unquote precarity or the contingency of the American workforce. The fact is there's been a strategy by the corporate right to deunionize America. Income inequality has risen because of that. Misery has risen because of that. And that's the fact. In the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there's a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that came out that said – it was the first one conducted since 2005, and it looked at, it's called the Contingent Work Survey, and it looked at sort of the level of insecurity or contingent workers between 2005 and 2017. The fact of the matter is pure gig jobs like driving an Uber, et cetera, it accounts for less than 1% of total employment. Now, there's been some debate about these numbers, but even if you look at all the different debates about these numbers, the facts are the overwhelming number of American workers are going to jobs. The problem is that the corporate right and the super rich have been unbelievably dogged and successful in their attempt to deunionize this country. I'm a union organizer and a chief negotiator. I have had the pleasure of working with tens of thousands of ordinary workers in this country, helping them to form a union and then going to the negotiations table. As recently as 2016, when I was working with thousands of nurses, registered nurses in Philadelphia, who actually got it together, formed unions, went up against hospital management. And I have to tell you, there was a one firm. Let's just start with the one firm in one hospital called Einstein Medical Center. There was a professional union busting firm, a union busting consultant called IRI Inc. You can go look them up. You won't find that much, and that's not surprising because the professional union busters actually are hired by corporate firms. They come in, they wreak havoc in the workplace. They literally start a sort of mini terror campaign in the workplace. They do just, frankly, what Donald Trump and Steve Bannon are doing to the entire United States of America right now is what union busting firms do inside the workplace every time American workers try and form a union. It's incredibly hard to do. The laws are so stacked in favor of the corporations and against ordinary workers. And where you see workers prevailing, it's when they are getting what we call strike ready. It's when the workers understand there is nothing but their power, there is nothing but themselves that will actually free themselves from the kind of conditions that Gabe was describing when he began talking today, which is there are unbelievably outrageous conditions that ordinary workers are facing in this country day in and day out. The stress is high. People leave work and they're freaked out and they can't believe they made it through another day.
Jane, I'm hearing you, but yeah. I want to just note that, I mean, this is the moral of that, to me, marvelous movie, Sorry to Bother You, and Boots Riley in particular, but who made it. But the line is that economic justice, democracy, fairness, all come out. They don't come out of the marketplace, they come out of the workplace. And that the strike is is the basic tool of enforcement. Do we believe that? Do you believe that, Gabe? And I want your comment on it too, Chris Mackin.
Yeah, I believe that sort of without a doubt. I think Jane is absolutely right about that. And, you know, I would say to kind of bring some of this, the pieces of this conversation together, you know, I also think worker self-management is a great thing. But we have good examples of what happens in the late 19th century. Many, many farmers, you know, one of the largest social movements in this country's history, the Farmers Alliance, tried to form form cooperatives, and they were crushed by the political and economic power of Wall Street and of, you know, big railroad capital and so on. And what that means, what we can take from that, is that if workers aren't organized, right, if they don't win economic power and political power, then they're going to face overwhelming opposition. And what we have in all of our workplaces right now are some employers are nice guys, some are not nice guys. Most are probably not nice guys. But Chris is right. Some sure are as people.
I want Chris's last word on, I mean, before the break, on the fundamental rule that you got to fight it out at the workplace, maybe with strikes.
If I was a worker at Tesla, I would join a union and I would approach it that way. But that's there's more than one kind of workplace, so we need to sort this out as we talk further.
And we will. Coming up, sex workers and Uber drivers. Who can teach what to whom? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The spirit of rebellion in the air has reached prisons across the land, much of it unreported. But the taste of it is vivid in a film posted on the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee website.
Remember Attica!
Remember Attica!
Remember Jackson!
Remember Jackson!
Remember our incarcerated freedom fighters!
Remember our incarcerated freedom fighters!
Because I know how to strip floors, wax them, take the gum up off floors, and so I started doing that, and that was 16 cents an hour.
It's kind of like a modern-day plantation situation, specifically targeting poor people and most especially the most marginalized community, black and brown and LGBT community.
In more news that most of us missed this summer, a protest by about 500 sex workers took over Washington Square in Manhattan in June. The reporter Melissa Jira Grant covered it.
On this day, they were pissed off. I mean, instead of having a moment of silence to recognize how many sex workers have experienced violence, they had a moment of rage at police and at policymakers who were targeting them. This is a group of people who probably have all different kinds of ideas about how much they like their work or don't like their work. That's sort of not the relevant thing. Like, the relevant thing is nobody should be abused or mistreated or subject to violence because of the job that they do. We're talking about kind of like multiple industries, right? We're talking about working in strip clubs. We're talking about working in porn. We're talking about people who are working as independent escorts on the internet. We're talking about people who are doing street sex work, who have this shared political identity of sex worker. And it's very powerful. I mean, it's a way of saying that all of these different kinds of work, there's solidarity among all of those workers, even if what the work they do is different.
Every time I get into an Uber cab, as I told Melissa, I interview the driver in some depth as to how Mr. Uber is treating her or him.
So if you're worried about what your Uber driver is going through, right, maybe you're worried that they're not getting enough of a cut of like what you've paid, right? Because we don't know how much money Uber takes. It's always different. You might be worried that that Uber driver doesn't have control over when they can schedule their shifts, that they're just sort of pressed to be always on and always available and always take a customer when there's one available to them. That's actually not that different than what sex workers demands are on them. But the biggest distinction is that Uber is one corporate owner, right? Uber is one boss at the end of the day. For sex workers, there's as many bosses at this point, potentially, as there are workers because so many people are independent contractors, true independent contractors. And then there are also workplaces like strip clubs. There are workplaces like massage parlors where people might have like a formal boss who's scheduling them and setting their wages. But we're still talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of bosses in different workplaces. Talking with sex workers, though, what I most often hear people talk about when they're saying like who they're organizing against, right? So like you're thinking of like taking on Uber. They're taking on something much bigger and scarier than Uber. They're having to take on the culture. They're having to take on, you know, millennia of people looking down on women who sell sex. They're having to take on all of the laws that make them criminals just for what they do for a living. They're having to take on all of the judgment that sex workers live with. I think the obstacles are a lot higher for them. If anything, I think the Uber workers have some to learn from sex workers.
Melissa, why now? Activism in the sex work industry.
In a way, it's not that different from what's been going on across the board after Trump, right? I just feel like a lot of people who weren't all that politically engaged before the end of 2016 are plugging in and getting organized, whether, you know, that's in sort of mainstream groups or whether that's in, you know, kind of more new formations. I've never seen sex workers in the United States get behind a candidate who actually came out and said they support sex workers' rights. In New York, that's been Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And that's been Julia Salazar. Both of their campaigns have gotten a lot of attention because they're kind of these rising stars in the Democratic Party. But what also distinguishes them is they support sex workers' rights and they support the decriminalization of sex work.
That was Melissa Gura-Grant. Jane McAlevey, let me put it to you. After sex workers, who else needs to be organized, including mothers and other unpaid workers?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think at this point we're down to 6% organization in the so-called private sector. We're going to drop a little bit now in the so-called public sector, which is where a lot of the caring professions exist. Most workers in the United States need to form a union at this point. That's the simple truth, because it remains the best, fastest route to justice in the place that most Americans spend most working hours of the day, right, which is the workplace, sadly. We've never actually won the promise of the eight-hour workday from 100-something years ago. The promise that people were fighting for many years ago was, you know, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, and 8 hours for what you will, play, art, craft,
life,
children, you know, do something, right? And we're still fighting for the basics of the eight-hour workday. And I think that any worker who does not yet have a union would do well to figure it out. And truthfully, we're seeing it in the polls, right? 62% of Americans just said they support unions. 48% of American workers who don't have a union just said they'd like to be in a union. And what we have to do is challenge the vicious anti-union laws that have been put in place in this country that make it so very difficult for workers to actually achieve, you know, the simple justice of having a union and having a collective voice.
Jane McAlevey. We're supposing this hour that the resistance, capital R resistance in Trump time America, has turned up more readably in the workplace than in what we call politics. I mean, do we agree on that? That this is the real story? What is really interesting to me is what feels, and you just touched on it, Jane, like a planetary alignment of discontents in a, let's be real, a demoralized republic divided angrily now around what feels like a breakdown in the executive branch. Where are we going? What is next, Gabe, as you read these trends?
Yeah, well, I think you're right that the discontent with our moment is showing up in the workplace. And the way I think about this is that Trump is in all of our workplaces, right? The country feels dangerous. Our workplaces are getting more dangerous. You know, the president is a sexual harasser. Sexual harassment is all over the workplace. There's fraud, you know, fraud and theft going on in the federal government. Wage theft is the biggest category of theft in this country. And so, you know, as people are realizing that they're not happy with where the country is going, they're also realizing that that means something in their day-to-day life and how they relate to their colleagues and coworkers and how they relate to their boss. So, you know, it's an open question where it's going. It's very, very dangerous to predict. But we are, the last couple of years, we've seen measurable, observable upticks in strike rates. As Jane is saying, more people saying in surveys they want to join unions. And some industries where that's becoming very visible, education in particular. You know, as the unemployment rate has fallen and we've finally kind of recovered to pre-recession unemployment, I think that's fed that trend significantly. And the coincidence of that and discontent with the Trump administration and all that it embodies, I think, is fueling something. It's very hard to say what, but it depends upon people finding unity with others who they haven't experienced it unity with before. We talk, think about all the different kinds of workers we've talked about today. Sex workers, incarcerated people, teachers, nurses, hotel workers. Right? There's a very broad array of people who will actually need each other if they're going to wield real political power. And so can we articulate a collective identity that all those people identify with and feel like in the same way that Melissa was saying, you know, different kinds of sex workers have done that, we need to do it much more broadly.
We're not yet talking, though, about the core or the heart of the economy as such. Before we run out of time, Chris, I want to hear more about your guy, Owen Young, and a remarkable speech that you wrote up from 1927, but you wrote it up in last week's New Republic. And it's extraordinary, a comfortable, almost Republican vision of a workplace at peace in which, as you say, the money doesn't hire the workers. The workers hire the money the way you would to get a house mortgage. We need some money here. What are the rates? What are you offering? And we need your money for a while. Whatever happened? Was it real to begin with? What happened to that vision?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that what I found most interesting and inspiring about digging up that speech was that we were only 100 years in to the industrial experiment of capitalism. And this was the occasion was the building of Baker Library at the Harvard Business School. And he was delivering a speech for people who had come to celebrate that that place. And he shocked everyone in the audience with the speech he gave. Now, the speech he gave, again, was not a resist, fight speech. He was looking back at 100 years of capitalism and saying, you know what? I don't think we've started this on the right foot. It looks like we working people and engineers and people like me in management are becoming slaves to capital, to analysts, to Wall Street. When we should be working with each other, figuring out how to make good stuff, and he said, "How can the Harvard Business School help figure out how to avoid this wrong direction that capitalism has started on? How can we discover a world where there should be no hired men because everybody is working for themselves together, that they own the firms? Now this is the CEO of General Electric who's talking this way." And so he's resisting. You know, he's resisting the certain J.P. Morgan and certain people back in the day who arguably they won that fight for the time being. But his ideas didn't go away, and there are people talking about them today. It shows there's a certain contingency to the structures of work, and that we could do something about them. We can actually own them.
Jane, I got to hear from you. Was Owen Young smoking something in 1927, or is that still even a plausible goal?
Look,
everybody contributes to the work of this hospital, and we all do our best, and we're in the same game together, or something.
No, look, it's a lovely and beautiful goal, but the fact is, for that to play out in significant ways, the United States is going to require the working class to have the kind of power that's going to come from workers getting together and forming unity and running strikes, right? The point is to have political power that would enable a sort of mass use of the ownership strategy, it presupposes that we actually have to have political power to re-regulate corporations and capital.
Yes.
And for workers to have the kind of power needed, we've got a problem, which is that we don't have that power right now. And the way we're going to get there is when workers reunionize all over the United States, start using the strike weapon in huge numbers. And what we're seeing in a place like Oklahoma, I don't know if you've seen it, the most exciting part of the result of the strikes from last spring.
I haven't seen it. Tell
me. That Oh my God, almost every single one of the Republicans in the Oklahoma legislature who said no to the raises that were being demanded by the teachers, but more importantly, who said no to fair taxation, which the teachers were demanding to put money into the schools, 19 Republicans, only 6 are left standing because the teacher said, "We're coming for you." They ran for office. They turned themselves into candidates after their strike, and they just knocked out the overwhelming majority of Republicans from the state legislature who stood them down when they walked out on strike. And that is how you see the link between strike power and politics and what it means when ordinary people organize themselves and start fighting back against the kind of power structure that exists in this country, which is really genuinely so rigged against the American worker. It's extraordinary.
I'm embarrassed to hear it is news, but that stuff isn't allowed in Oklahoma, Jane. I mean, that sort of...
Oh, it's amazing what's happening in Oklahoma. I literally, every morning I wake up and I keep retweeting the same story from Oklahoma. It is the most exciting story of the electoral season so far. I mean, I know Alexandria Cortez, Presley, all these people, there's a lot of exciting things happening. I'm looking at a deep red state called Oklahoma. And the first gains that Democrats have made in that state is coming as a direct result of the strike wave that happened in Oklahoma last year. And literally the teachers saying, you turned down funding our school. Like they actually won a great raise, but what they were fighting for was fixing their schools, which is what all good teachers fight for. And they looked at the power structure. They came off the picket lines. They looked at that power structure. They literally made a plan. They all decided to run for office, and they just beat the living something out of a bunch of really bad men who were just didn't care about the public school system in Oklahoma. It is such an important and such an exciting story. It's what happens when workers get unified.
Is there another fight like that coming?
Well, as Jane said, it's spreading now from the red states that we saw in the spring into L.A. It looks like it's likely to have a teacher strike. Seattle just barely averted one, and the rest of Washington State will. It looks like 12,000 Marriott workers around the country are about to vote to authorize a strike. Workers at U.S. Steel, of whom there are now 16,000. There used to be 300,000. There's now 16,000 of them, and they're preparing a strike vote. You know, there's no single fight on the horizon that we can predict will be the one that kicks everything off, but it is spreading, and we should expect it to keep spreading as people catch the bug again. When you see someone else do something that's inspiring to you, you're likelier to do it too.
We still haven't talked about the giants, Google, Apple, Facebook, this kind of thing.
Right.
But are you sold on the battle here, Chris?
Well, that's actually what got me writing that piece for the New Republic was the news in mid-August that like 300 Google workers had signed a petition challenging their CEO for developing a plan to go back into China to do the business of the communist government there and without getting the consent of the Google employees. The Google employees didn't want to be a party to that kind of work, and they bravely signed a petition together. And it occurred to me that this is a very promising development too, and that I think we are seeing among those quote high tech workers. Hopefully, this will happen at Amazon in a different way, probably. But where people are standing up and saying we demand a voice, and that's. So that's happening there. It's happening in other places. One quick thing I'd throw in here, Chris, in terms of just the context of this discussion. I think to achieve justice, we need more than one tool. And I like to think about this in terms of negative power and positive power. I'm all for negative power when those teachers had to fight their legislatures to get what they justly deserve. And the more of that, the better. But there are also positive power strategies where people can actually begin to take things over and take responsibility for things. And that's what we need. We need more than one arrow in our quiver to do the work that needs to be done.
In your New Republic piece, Chris Mackin, you quoted the late, great economist Paul Samuelson saying, in effect, that we don't talk about it, but we have agreed to rent out 8 hours a day. And not just the hours, but essentially our minds, our hearts, our consciences to the people who pay us.
Well, thank you.
What they pay.
Thank you, Chris. A reading from Professor Samuelson and his 1976 text that many people in your audience learn from. Quote, since slavery was abolished, human earning power is forbidden by law to be capitalized. A man is not even free to sell himself. He must rent himself at a wage. So the human rental relationship is the core of the employment relationship. There's something wrong when workers are renters in the workplace.
And we're just beginning to realize it. Thank you all. Jane McAlevey, Gabe Winant, Chris Mackin, and Melissa Gira-Grant. You can hear more of Melissa's report about sex workers on our website at radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by good, hard workers all. Producer Rebecca Panofka, the artist Susan Coyne, our engineer George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our labor boss. I'm Christopher Ledden. I just work here. Join us next time on Open Source.